episode 824, My Strength is My Story with Amy Blankson, The Future of Happiness.
Moms, needing a little inspiration and a ray of hope? You've come to the right place. This is the show that you can turn to for just the pick-me-up you need. This is Create Your Now, Your Best Selfie. Here's your host, certified life coach, personal trainer, and nutritionist, Christiane Wargo. Staring at a
stop sign, watching. Happy, happy day. Guess what? Today is My Strength is My Story Day, and we have on an incredible, extraordinary, accomplished woman, Amy Blankson. Oh, I cannot wait to share her with you. But first, we have to welcome in all of her family, her friends, and also all of our brand new family. Welcome to our family here at Create Your Now. I'm so delighted of your presence. If you already haven't had the opportunity, you'll want to head on over to createyournow.com where you can learn more and sign up for the Kisses newsletter, the Keep It Simple Strategy Everyday Solutions to Live, Love, and Impact. And you know what? Today is a happy day with Amy. I had time to sit down with her and we chatted about the future of happiness. This coffee chat is going to give you hope. Even in a digital era, you are going to learn strategies and tools, and you're going to want to pick up her book. Of course, all of that information will be in the show notes. But with Amy, oh my goodness gracious, I don't even know where to begin. So you know what? Without further ado, let's jump right on into our coffee chat with Amy Blankson, The Future of Happiness. Hello and welcome to Create Your Now. I am so excited to have you a part of My Strength is My Story series. And today we have on an amazing, incredible, extraordinary woman. Her name is Amy Blankson. She's a wife and mother of three daughters. She's the co-founder of GoodThink, a global positive psychology consulting firm, and the author of her brand new book, The Future of Happiness: 5 Modern Strategies for Balancing Productivity and Well-Being in the Digital Era. That's a mouthful, but you're going to love her book. Amy is also the only person to be named a point of light by 2 presidents, President George H.W. Bush and President Bill Clinton, for creating a movement to activate positive culture change. Most recently, Amy was a featured professor in Oprah's Happiness Course. She has also written an award-winning children's book. If that's not enough to make you happy, Amy, come on in. I'm so happy that you're here.
Oh, thank you so much, Christina. This is such a joy to get to join you this morning.
Oh, well, it's my pleasure to have you on. I mean, you know, it's awesome when girls can just get together and chat. And when you're chatting about being happy, what could be better?
Absolutely. This is wonderful.
Well, tell us a little bit about you, where you are right now, and what keeps you hopping.
Ooh, great question. So right now in my life, I just moved to Dallas about a year ago, so I've settled into being a Texan again in my life. I've got 3 little girls who are 9, 7, and 4, and a busy life and travel schedule that helps me to really appreciate when things calm down and to also practice what I preach. Often with positive psychology, I'm using the skill sets I talk about every single day in my life, but I have learned so much and I'm really excited to share with everyone some of the research that I've come across that I think could be really helpful for them.
Awesome. Well, that's great. And with 9, 7, and 4 little girls, I'm not sure about daddy, but there's a lot of estrogen going on
there's
in that household.
Absolutely.
Maybe he needs to take some estrogen, you know, to maybe balance it off to keep him sane. I don't know, but that maybe that's for another episode. Oh, well, let's talk about happiness here for a minute, because I love your book and I enjoyed reading it completely front to back. And what I loved about it is you have contained in this book, and of course we will have the link in the show notes for you to pick up your own copy. But in here you talk about happiness, obviously, the future of happiness. And in it, it contains some of the favorite, you know, apps and also happy hacks. So as we're talking today, for the listeners, when you pick up your own copy, you're going to want to go back and check these little happy hacks out and how you can begin to implement it. But before we get into all of your different strategies, we'll cover a few of those. I want you to define for us, Amy, kind of the Webster's Dictionary of what you consider happiness is.
Ooh, great question. So it's so important to start off with that question because I think so often people have very different perceptions of what happiness means mm-hmm. from just a sense of pleasure from worldly goods and experiences to something that relates to well-being, and other people are thinking about it as an emotional state. So when I define happiness, I'm using the ancient Greek definition, which is the joy that we feel striving after our potential. And I love this definition because for me, it's not about sitting still and just soaking up the sun. It's really about growing and becoming and discovering a sense of purpose. You're moving on a trajectory towards somewhere. And so positive psychology is really helpful in that domain because it helps you to figure out, what do I need to do to get from point A in my life to point B? I want to become this, but how do I get there? What do I do? And so often it's about our mindset. It's about the way that we think about the world and that we actually have control over our happiness and our perception of the world. In fact, we learned from positive psychology that only 10% of our happiness is determined by our external environment, which means that if you or the listeners tell me how much money you make, where you live, how many kids you have, and maybe what your job title is, I can accurately predict your happiness levels, but only by 10%, because the other 90% is actually up to you. It's a mixture of your genes and your perception of the world. 90%. So for the listeners out there and the viewers, we can perceive the same conversation in entirely different ways based on our childhood, our past experiences, our information base that we have. But when we bring all that information to bear in our lives, you can really shape and choose a path for yourself that is not dictated by what's going on in your life or where you've come from in the past, but really where you want to go in the future. And so it's a great question to start with, because I think as we talk about moving towards the future of happiness, what does that mean? And for me, that means striving to become the best version of ourselves that we want to be and to find the greatest joy.
So how do you define your happiness, though? You're striving and growing, but you've got 90% in your control. What makes Amy happy?
What makes Amy happy? So it's interesting that I have actually made a list of things to remind myself what makes me happy. And my list differs from my husband's list, which I found to be fascinating. For him, he really ticks when he has, I call it the Fs. It's a family and friends and fitness and faith. And those things really drive him. And while those are all factors in my life as well, some of the things that really keep me ticking are community service to other people. It's art, it's getting to play music, it's dancing. I think I'm much more on the creative arts end of happiness. And ironically, those are some of the first things to go when life gets busy. Those things that make me happy are the things that I see as almost luxury experiences in my life. You know, I'm lucky if I get to sit down and practice piano. It's been a long time since I have, but when I do, it reminds me, oh yeah, this is what drives me. This is what can help me keep going towards the other things that I need to accomplish in my life.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. That is fascinating. And I love that you connected it even with your husband, you know, mm-hmm. to where, because, you know, I mean, sometimes we think it's just all about me.
Right.
And where it's, but when you're in a marriage, when you have children, when there's a, you know, there's this devotion, you're committed in a relationship, there's got to be some crossover. And so thank you so much for acknowledging that crossover in happiness.
Absolutely. You know, we've been married for 15 years now, so we're learning a few tricks along the way. And I think that it took a long time for us to realize that we perceive and think differently about experiences and ways of loving each other too, right? Mm-hmm. I know that the book about the five love languages has been really influential in our life because it says that some people receive love or feel love, sometimes based on gifts, sometimes on words of encouragement or acts of service or physical touch. And I'm forgetting a fifth one right now. But I found it so interesting that some people give in certain ways and other people receive in different ways. So I might give through acts of service, but I receive through words of encouragement. And the same for my husband and the same for my children. Every one of us has a different level of receiving and giving that really plays out in our lives. And I think to acknowledge those can help us all to bolster each other, but both with love, but also with happiness, and to really fulfill each other's place within the family.
Yes. Oh, that is beautifully said, Amy, because I do believe there is that crossover when it comes to love. But when you're loved and you feel loved, you know how to give it, you know how to receive it, you're happy.
It's true. It's so true. There's a strong interplay there between the way that we love and the way we feel happy. And from positive psychology, I love to cross over between the two, because positive psychology says that social support is the single greatest predictor of long-term happiness and success. It is more strongly predictive of how long you'll live than obesity, high blood pressure, and smoking, which is crazy, right? We know those things can really predict longevity, but your happiness and your social support is actually a better predictor of how long you're going to live and how much joy you'll feel. And the research that's coming out now says that if you provide social support to other people, you are 40% more likely to receive it in return, which means, you know, within a company setting, a lot of times companies will ask people, you know, how supported do you feel by the company? And they'll say, you know, I feel like my company, you know, we have company picnics and we get together a lot. but those are questions of what is the company doing for me? What is my community doing for me? Or as we've all heard, you know, what is my country doing for me? But I think the question, if we can flip it around, if, like, what are you doing to help other people? Really, it calls us to the mat to think about what we're doing in our lives. If we have a friend who's struggling, do they come to us for social support? Or if a colleague is behind on their work, are we the ones who are offering to help bring them up to speed? Or if we have somebody who needs an extra hand, are we volunteering our time or are we waiting for other people to fill in the gap? And I think that answer to that question really comes back to this idea of how much social support do we want to receive? And if it's a bit of a selfish turn on that question, but I think that if we want to receive social support in return, the more we can give to other people, the more we'll see it in our own lives.
Definitely. And I think it's important too, that we have to learn and understand to give at the same time, being able to take care of ourselves by defining, what is happiness for us?
Yes.
You know, because then if we're working outside of our boundaries where we set up, you know, and like, oh, not that I feel uncomfortable, because we need to, I'm one who says get out of your comfort zone. Mm-hmm. But when you're working outside of your boundaries as to your happiness boundaries, that's a different story.
Yes, absolutely. Well, so when we started our company back in 2007, my brother, Sean Acor, he's also my co-founder of Good Think, he wrote a book called The Happiness Advantage, and it was very much focused on how do we find personal happiness. And it came down to happiness being a choice and something that we practice in our lives. And I think that message is absolutely a first step in this process. But I think the happiness movement has done a disservice to people by only focusing on our personal happiness. We've got so much attention, particularly among millennials who are growing up with this message that happiness is important, to stop there and assume that our happiness is the tantamount experience, right? But I think that when we take it that next step, that other people's happiness drives our own, then you really start to get beyond the individual happiness level and you're looking at, okay, what does it mean to create happiness on a larger scale for a community, for a family, for a school or an organization? How do I contribute and fit into that bigger picture? So I do agree, happiness, personal happiness is a wonderful starting place, and it's hard to serve other people until you have sort of filled up yourself in some level to be able to know that you matter and that your behavior matters and that you're in a good place. But the next step is to not stop there, but to continue striving towards the next level as well.
Definitely. And you're going to want to keep striving, because you're going to want to know more from the future of happiness. Amy writes in her book, 5 Modern Strategies for Balancing Productivity and Well-being in the Digital Era. Of course, we will have the link in the show notes for you on this. Okay, so we've defined happiness. We've defined your, you know, what makes Amy happy. What did you find most challenging in your life? And maybe, you know, maybe in your life, because you're a young mother. I mean, 9 years old and younger, that's a young mom. They're keeping you busy. I remember those days. I'm past that younger age, but I do remember them very well. What did you find most challenging in your life when it comes to being happy?
That's a great question. I think one of my greatest challenges has been that I struggle with a bit of personal anxiety, that something that I've had since I was very young and didn't really have the words for it until I got older. But when I am particularly stressed out or anxious or tense for some reason, I don't breathe particularly well. I almost forget to breathe, and then I get into this go mode where I'm spinning my wheels, but I'm not super effective. And I'm also not the person that I fully want to be. And so I've found the positive psychology has been really helpful to me to understand not only what's going on internally, but also to strategize for when I see myself ramping up to be more anxious, or when I'm in the moment of being anxious, what do I do about it? And some of it is just breathing. It's having reminders to breathe.
Exactly.
To be fully honest, some of it is taking an antidepressant that I think helped to find a stabilizing baseline where I return to a place where I really felt like I was being myself and I could do some of these positive practices because I could focus on some of the higher level practices. And I found that to be a really important message, I think, as a positive psychology and a happiness researcher, that people think that sometimes they should be able to be happy all on their own, and they get very frustrated that they can't, that they've been trying and trying and trying, and they're depressed, and it's a hard place to move out of with willpower. And so one of the things I've learned that you can use every tool at your disposal, from journaling and meditation, antidepressants, social support, doing things for other people, all of these become a toolbox that when you're struggling, they are crucial to your success. And I use them all. But one particular example from the new book that I think really illustrates where we're heading with the future of happiness is that there's I tested a number of gadgets and wearables that are designed to raise our happiness by increasing our consciousness about our own behavior and giving you a sort of a sneak peek window into your own mind in a way that we've never been able to before the technological revolution. And so one of these gadgets that I tried out was called the Spire Stone, and I wish I had brought it here with me today, but it is a small little clip that attaches to either your bra strap or your waistband of your jeans, and it's measuring your respiration, which is, you can see why I was really interested in this particular wearable. And in real time, it's providing feedback on an app where you can watch your breath go up and down. And based on your breathing patterns, it'll say you're feeling calm, you're feeling stressed, you're tense, you're anxious, you're happy, you're focused. And ironically, when I first started trying out this wearable, I wore it for about 3 days, and I think I racked up 1 minute of focus. I didn't realize how unfocused I was according to my breathing patterns, but I've gotten better. I think I've gotten up to maybe 44 minutes a day. It's shocking how unfocused I am at times, but
maybe you're just a heavier breather overall.
Maybe so. I don't know. Maybe I've got to calibrate it better. But it's been spot on when I feel tense. And what happens is when I feel tense, it'll start to vibrate really gently. And a message will pop up on either my watch or my phone saying, "You're feeling tense." And so this one particular time, about a couple days into trying out the Spire Stone, my daughter had been playing in the pool at home. And she unfortunately had a little friend jump onto her horseplay in the pool. And it broke her neck. And it was just this horrible accident. She's fine now, fortunately. So she's recovered lovely, and I'm sure her neck is stronger than ever before. But at the time, it was a bit of an emergency. And so I remember taking her to the hospital and going into the doctor for the x-rays. And the whole time, my Spire Stone was on, and it was saying that I was supernaturally calm. You know, that mother-like calm you get when you're in go mode. I don't know what was going on, but I was focused for that minute. It did not say I was tense until we were leaving the hospital, and I was walking out, and all of a sudden, the Spire Stone starts to vibrate and says, "You're feeling tense." I was like, "Yeah, I know." Thanks for the insight. But it was just enough of a reminder to me to stop and say, okay, why am I feeling tense? Mm-hmm. And what came to me in the moment was not I was tense about my daughter's neck being broken, but I was tense because I was worried about what other parents in the hospital would think about me walking out with a child who had a broken neck. And that wasn't really what I wanted to be thinking about at that moment, but very genuinely was what I was stressed about. And so in about 30 seconds, I was able to mindfully pivot from that awareness point to, okay, this is who I really want to be. I want to be there for my daughter, who's the one going through all of this, who's going to have to walk into school wearing a neck brace, who's going to have to give up gymnastics for the summer and not be able to swim. And so I did. I was able to make that switch. And I think that before I had that Spirestone on to give me that instantaneous feedback loop, it probably would have taken me a month or longer, maybe not a month, maybe a week or longer, to realize that that was something that was bubbling under the surface. And instead, I was able to name it and pivot it and move on. And so when I write in The Future of Happiness about technology, technology is both distracting, it's horribly distracting at times, but it's also incredibly helpful. And so what I want people to be able to do is to discern better what technology in my life is moving me forward and what technology is holding me back. And I want to call people to the place of being able to say, this is important for me to figure out now. We are flooded with technology on all sides of our lives. We have wires and gadgets and gizmos all around us, and it's only going to continue as the Internet of Things, you know, steps into our world, and we have Alexa and we've got Siri and we've got, you know, all these
interesting names.
Yeah, exactly. There are these inputs into our lives that could be helpful, and they can also be really distracting. So which ones are being most helpful? And in the process of being able to walk through testing out so many of these, I hope to give readers and listeners some real insight into what was useful for me, and then for them to ask similar questions to themselves of what is it time to let go of, and what is it time to hang on to? I call it fuse it or lose it in the book. And I think it's a pretty helpful litmus test to ask yourself in the moment.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And you'll want to pick up your own copy of The Future of Happiness, 5 Modern Strategies for Balancing Productivity and Well-Being in the Digital Era. Amy, you go through the book and you talk about 5 strategies. I know in our household, and when I was reading your book, talk about being honest, and thank you so much for just being very vulnerable and sharing your story. We become a little bit fearful mm-hmm. of the unknown, of the technology, for what we see on the media. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, all these hacks here, hacks there. Somebody's going to, you know, identity theft, all of this. I mean, yeah, I do very, you know, I make sure I take care of my information appropriately, et cetera. But we can't escape where the digital era is leading us. Technology is here to stay.
Absolutely.
So when you're looking at having all of these gadgets, because when I was reading your book, back to my little story here, is I started counting, and I have one that I wear on my wrist. I've got one that I wear up here, and I have a couple others that are on my phone. I won't bring that out because that'll be another distraction. I have it muted right now. I don't need any more distractions. Right? And then I calculate, I mean, with 5 children and the hubby and myself and having an online business, I mean, we're doing awesome here because we get to use technology. You're north. I mean, I'm north. You're south in the U.S., and we're communicating video and audio. How cool is that? But at the same time, there's so much to be had. How do you even begin to figure out what's right for you as an individual?
So that's such an important point. I think that it is something that's going to differ for everybody. Mm-hmm. But the principle I try to draw out in the book, at the very beginning of the book, is this idea of figuring out how to stay grounded. And in the same way that, you know, when you plug in an electrical outlet into the wall, if you have a grounding plug on the wire, that's that third prong, it actually helps to channel the energy. And I think it's such a great visual analogy for me to think about, okay, what is my third prong? What am I using to help focus in on what's most important, because there are so many different ways that I could use technology that seem like I'm being productive but might actually be counterproductive. And so what I talk about with the third prong is thinking about a set of guiding principles that we can start to establish now in our lives very explicitly, writing them down about how you want to engage with technology. And this could be from certain social cues, like when someone walks into the room, I'm going to commit to looking up from my device to make eye contact and say hello. Surprising that we've moved away from that one, right? That we can have, my children can walk in the room and I actually haven't looked up from my phone for 10 minutes to even see what they're up to. I mean, that's horrible. That's not who I want to be. So I'm putting that on my list of grounding principles. I want to make eye contact. I want to have the ability to single task when I want to single task, which means that I am going to put my phone away when I'm driving. I'm going to put my phone away when I'm at the dinner table. And these are personal choices that I'm making. Now, as a mother, I can help my children learn some of these because I'm setting the boundaries, right? I can't necessarily control my husband, although I can try. I can write him a book and call him out in public, and we'll see what that leads to. But
I did see those couple of notes. Now I hope he doesn't get this far.
I know. He's read through the book multiple times to help me to edit and to write, and so he knows what's coming. But I think that for other people, maybe their grounding principles are a little bit different, that based on your beliefs or your intentions, your goals in life, your intentions and your grounding might change. When you're a young mother, that it might look different when you are a more seasoned professional or when you're a teenager. But I think that it's important to revisit those, because what I found is that individuals who write down their goals are 42% more likely to achieve them. So this isn't just generically thinking about who you want to be. This is writing down a set of principles for yourself. In the next 5 years, this is who I want to be. And this is where I draw the line to say, I'm not going to do this because I know it inhibits who I want to become. And I have a great example of a friend who on his iPhone screen, he made himself his own little graphic. And when he goes to swipe open his phone, he has an arrow that points to the right in green that says, towards my goals. And he has an arrow in red that points the other direction that says away from my goals. And so every time he goes to swipe open his phone, it's his check. It's his gut check that says, do I want to open my phone or do I not? Is it helping me or hurting me? And that's so important, because the recent research is that the average individual opens and closes their phone 150 times a day. And that sounds like a lot, but when you put it, wait for this, when you think about it, in terms of how long it takes you to open and close your phone and check a message in between, if we average, and we optimistically said it took on average 1 minute to open and close your phone, 150 times 1 minute is 2.5 hours of your day opening and closing your phone on average. And that doesn't include people like us who are on technology all the time. I probably have a far worse rate than I want to admit of how often I open and close. So when I think of my friend's litmus test, do I open or close my phone? It's a great grounding principle to say, okay, I'm going to cut down the number of times I check one by one. Maybe I'll move down to 140 today, but that means that I got 10 minutes back of my life to do something else that I really want to do. And that's so important. So I think there's some principles that are in the book that'll give people some great strategies to make this very practical for themselves.
Mm-hmm. And so very well put there, Amy, because I do think we have a problem. We want to strategize. We want to have things in our toolbox, but we're not willing to look at ourselves specifically and go, what works for me? Mm-hmm. And defining that and structuring it accordingly and making those changes. Like you said, when your season changes, your focus, your boundaries, what you see, your principles, they may shift a little bit. Your values may not, your morals may not, but your principles and how you're leading those boundaries. I think about like the invisible fence. In fact, maybe I've read a lot of books lately, but didn't talk about a dog in the book and the invisible
fence?
Yes,
I do. Yes.
Okay, good. I was like, wasn't that in the book or was I dreaming that? Okay. Whew. Okay. I'm saved there. But you know, it is that whole thing is that we need to set these up, but they may shift a little bit, based on our seasons. And I absolutely love, because this is the first point, like you said, very early in your book, that you talk about staying grounded and having that third prong. And if you've ever been shocked by electricity, which we're not going to tell them that story because you talk about that when you guys are playing when you were younger. So they have to get a copy of their own book, Amy, to hear that story so they can read it themselves. It's a good story, so you want to pick up your own copy. So with that, staying grounded, that third prong, finding what fits for you. What would you say, what's an easy either app or a way for them to begin to define even just the first step? What would you tell somebody?
I think the first step is gathering information, because it's hard to change something that you don't know what's wrong or where you're at to start off with. And so one of the apps that I think is really useful is called Break Free. And it can tell you how often you open and close your phone every day. It can tell you how long you're spending on each app or on the phone in general, how much battery power it uses. But I think having that basic information of knowing, okay, in my life, I'm actually at like 300 times of unlocking the phone. Oh my gosh, I'm twice the average. I'm not. But I think that if I knew that, it would be really helpful. Other people might find that opening their phone is not a big temptation. In the book, I write about different tech personas. So I'd identify three tech personas. One is a tech embracer. So these are people who are the first early adopters of a technology. They love tech. They're willing to try anything. The second tech persona is a tech acceptor, and that's somebody who has been watching from a distance. They'll adopt a technology if they have to, or if it's been pretty well tested, or if their boss makes them. They're not happy about it, but they're okay with it. And then the third group is the tech resistor, and these are individuals that are putting their feet in the sand, and they're like, no way, I am not getting a smartphone. I love my flip phone. I don't even need a phone. I'll leave my phone at home just to make a statement. So I think that it's important to identify for yourself where you fit on that spectrum. And when I think about the tech resistors that I know in my life, they're not really addicted to the number of times they open and close their phone. That might not be their issue. But for a tech embracer, it really might be. That's something that they are constantly attached to technology. And so detaching might be the strategy. For somebody who's a resistor, it might be simply overcoming a fear of technology and being more willing to explore and be open-minded about opportunity and possibility. So I think that helps. But for those individuals like myself who are tech embracers, the Break Free app is a wonderful place to start, to just get some information and then know where you're at so then you can make some changes in your life.
Awesome. And of course, when you pick up your own copy, she has in the back of the book, if I remember correctly, because I got her pre-copy and then I actually got the copy of the book. But in the back, there's a whole listing of the apps, all of the research that she found, everything. So if you're one who wants to little, you know, geek out, maybe you truly are this social, you know, the social person who wants to know where technology is going, this is going to be chock full of information. Or maybe you're just a truly concerned mom that says, I want to know where the future of happiness is and how this is going to affect my family. Because when you're the CEO of the family, you know, we've got a lot of responsibilities resting on our shoulders. And so with that, I want to talk about Habitat for Happiness.
Absolutely.
I love, because of course we, you know, you're on Create Your Now. So it's all about creating your now, the actions that you take. Because what you say in your book is that happiness is a choice.
Absolutely.
Yeah, if it's a choice, then you talk about strategy, I think it's number four, if I remember correctly, about creating this habitat of happiness. Talk a little bit about that.
So you read the book really well. You know the strategy numbers. I'm impressed. Strategy number four, create your own habitat, is very near and dear to my heart, because I could think we've talked for years now about the 90% of our happiness that we can control. And for the most part, because it was a smaller percentage, we ignored the external environment. But I wanted to spend a little time actually honing in, particularly as women, to think about what can we do with that 10%. Because it still impacts our life. There are things going on around us that we can choose to shape the factors that are taking place. And so I go through in the book and I talk about very practical ways that you can organize your home, your office, your school, the places you learn and play and grow to set yourself up for a greater level of happiness. And it can be as simple as creating spaces within your home to allow for more happiness to come in. And that could be one of the examples I talk about is the tech graveyard. And I love this idea because I personally struggle with it.
I have a few bins, and they're really, mine are like the big, huge Rubbermaid ones.
Oh, yes.
They're not the little clear, so I haven't even gotten that far yet. But yes, go ahead, continue.
Oh, my goodness. Well, because I wanted to try out everything I talk about in the book, I had tried the strategy myself, and I went from a sort of cursory, like, yeah, it's probably time to let go and recycle some of those old things, to, okay, this is actually really hard. Like, it takes a lot of time, and it's kind of overwhelming to figure out, what do I do with this? At home, I have 4 laptops stacked up, 4 MacBooks that I know are broken of some sort. They've got data on it that I want to be very careful about how I dispose of it. Mm-hmm. But they're taking up space, and someone else could probably be benefiting from them. I mean, they're valuable, right? So I went to go figure out how to erase the data, and I wanted to explore all the different resources that people could use. And what I learned was that when you have a broken screen or a broken battery or a trackpad that doesn't work, or you've lost the charger, it's really hard. And so in the book, I talk through some strategies about where you can go to get help with deleting data, where you can recycle, and people will help you for free to take care of or take some of these items off your hand and be able to pass them along to somebody that is going to be able to utilize them. Like, for instance, I learned from a good friend of mine that domestic abuse survivors often need cell phones because they're on the go and they're flying from a particular situation. So all these old cell phones I've been hiding in my drawer could actually be going to a good purpose. And I certainly don't want to throw them out, right? Because they're, I spend a lot of money on them, and they're, right, somebody can use them. They're just old. They're not broken in some senses. So, how do we deal with this? How do we make space within all those drawers and closets and cabinets in my house to repurpose things effectively, and then to invite in space for me to set up art supplies or to, be able to have space to start on new creative ideas with my children? And how do I have space for all the new technology that keeps coming into my life? I mean, you know, the holidays come and everybody gives each other gadgets. And now I'm like, no more gadgets, because I have nowhere to put them. I think that this is something that is becoming a universal experience for us as a society, right? 10 years ago, this wasn't a big deal. But all of a sudden now we have some people have 8-tracks, and you've got VHSs, and you've got the mini DV8s, and you've got the CDs and the DVDs, and now you've got all these online clouds, and it's these things are flying into our lives so fast that if we don't deal with them right now, they're going to only continue to pile up and make you feel overwhelmed more. And so in the book, I talk about something called the GOT syndrome. It stands for GOT, guilt over things. And boy, do I got the GOT syndrome. I think that it is something that I feel like inhibits my happiness. And as somebody who craves order and craves the ability to more effectively think and calm my environment down, both for myself and for the environment I want to create for my family, I've got to learn to deal with this right now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So. And when you deal with that, I bet your happiness scale goes up.
Absolutely. It sure does. When I look at that clean desk and the spot where those 4 laptops were sitting for more years than I care to admit, I am so happy. I'm like, I did it. I was able to figure out a resource that is so simple and so quick and so effective in my life. So it's been great.
That's awesome. I love that, because you've got to create your space that you want. And it's unfortunate that a lot of us are just kind of choosing, because it is a choice. We can choose to create the space we really want, or we can just choose to let life happen to us and at us, and just right, let things be thrown, you know, towards us. And we're playing defense instead of coming up from, you know, from the aspect of playing offense.
Absolutely. And we have systems for almost everything else in our lives, from spring cleaning to getting ready for the annual garage sale. We have these processes for dealing with everything but technology. And that's because we're in uncharted territory. We've never had to do this before. Mm-hmm. And now we're kind of making things up as we go. And so my plan is to help people have a plan of attack. Let's get strategic. Let's figure out a system so that every year after this, it's easier. It's just, we fall into a rhythm when we're cleaning out the garage, we're going to clean out the tech graveyard. And it's not so overwhelming for people.
Yeah. Well, when you were doing your research on this, Amy, what was one of the things that stood out and surprised you the most that maybe hindered happiness through the digital era and where we are now?
I think one of the most shocking pieces of research is that it's called a study of mere presence. And it says that the mere presence of an object in your environment can actually impact you even if you never touch it. So specifically, the study was done with a cell phone. And it said that the mere presence of a cell phone, whether on the table, by your laptop, in the middle of a conversation, even if you never touch the phone or look at it, can still decrease your feelings of closeness and your feelings of effectiveness and productivity. And the reason why is because your brain is anticipating that you're going to be needed. So we're almost like Pavlov's dogs who've been trained with a bell, right? And we all have this dinger that is something we recognize now, and you hear it and everybody perks up like, oh, I think I'm needed again. And as much as we love it, there's this love-hate feeling with somebody needs me. It's addicting to be needed in a way. It's intoxicating. And so I think that it really resonated with me and made sense that when I have my cell phone right here beside me, it could impact the way I relate to other people. And so my new strategy is I simply take my phone and I'll either hide it behind my laptop screen where I can't find it, or I'll tuck it into a bag, or if I'm having a conversation with somebody, I will put it in a back pocket, anywhere that's out of my visual line of sight. And I found that that's been really effective for helping me have that impulse control over, do I need to check it? Or maybe something came through, or, whoa, I don't know what's going on in the world. The National Center for Biotechnology Information recently said that the human attention span has dropped below that of a goldfish, which sounds ridiculous, right? I mean, I didn't even know goldfish had an attention span. Well, it turns out they don't really.
And who's studying that anyway? That's my concern.
That is a great question. I better figure that one out.
Yeah, check that one out and let me know.
Absolutely. But apparently we don't have attention spans either anymore, and it's been declining rapidly. So I want to recover my attention and focus. I want to feel like I'm not scattered and all over the place. And so any strategy I can use right now to begin to recover that in my life is going to be really important.
Yeah, and we need to have an attention span much longer than a goldfish.
Absolutely.
I think a goldfish has 8 seconds, and we're under that now.
The goldfish is 9 seconds, but we're 8 seconds.
Oh, okay. I was a second off. I was trying to make us a little more hopeful.
So sad.
Yes, it is. It is sad. I mean, I don't want to consider myself a goldfish. I mean, and how do you think that plays? You know, taking this, I'm totally skipping to your next book that you're going to write. So I'm just going to tell you what you need to write on.
Who'd you tell me?
The future of happiness, you could go even further. And you have young children. I mean, you know, you have the millennials even. How is this going to affect our younger generations coming up? Because they're being born with, I mean, almost like a phone in their hand. Now, I was not that mother. We had technology in our household, but I still have a son, believe it or not, 5 children. He's in 6th grade. He does not have a cell phone.
Wow.
That's just something that we have chosen not to do. Now, he does have a computer, but he doesn't carry that computer. You know, it's for school. But we've chosen, he doesn't need a cell phone. Mama's there. Daddy's there to take care of things. Now, that's our choice, of course. But that would be very fascinating to carry this research on for your next book or 2 or 3 books, you know, as to how is it going to affect? I mean, do you have any idea? Could you make a prediction? I mean, why not? Let's talk predictions here with the future of happiness and where this might take us.
Absolutely. So I think when I wrote this book, what really surprised me was that no matter which audience I was talking to, whether it's executives or it's children, it's working parents, actually more specifically adults in this case, people hear this topic in terms of their children. They hear it first for their children because that's where the pain point is in our lives right now. We have this massive concern as a society about where are we heading? What is this going to look like? That this is completely unprecedented. And we've seen probably the worst iteration of technology at this point, where the pendulum has swung from no technology to, oh my gosh, it's everywhere. Yes. And I think what's happening is they're actually starting to come back to the middle. And I hope that my book is part of that process of coming back to a sense of balance, because what we see happening is that the Generation X went from no technology to a lot of technology, right? But the digital natives and the millennials are actually being raised with a different level of knowledge. The parents have a different level of information about how to set boundaries. They know that we need boundaries because they've seen the tech tantrums when you have a child. I have a friend who has a little boy who he has this obsession with remote controls and gadgets and screens, and there is a compulsion that when you have, when you try to take the technology away from him, he will flip out. Wow. He will freak out. And I call it a tech tantrum, because it's so ridiculous. I mean, he's like 9 years old and you would think he'd have self-control, but he doesn't like having things taken away that he felt like was his right. I think what's going to benefit the younger generations is that we as parents know what that looks like, and we don't want to go back there. And so the younger generation, we're telling them, you will have boundaries. This is what it's going to look like. Screen time is limited. We didn't even have the word screen time a few years ago. Now everyone's like, oh, no more than 2 hours of screen time, right? Right. So now the younger generation hears this. And I even heard my younger daughter, who's four, say, oh, my screen time is up. Like, it's just assumed. You will have boundaries as long as you're in my household. But I think when we look at the Generation Xers and the millennials who are around the early 20s right now, it's almost like technology was a right. So if you try to take it away from them, they get flustered. But the younger generation is thinking, oh, okay, well, my time is up. I've hit the boundary line. I know where it is now. This is those invisible boundaries that we're learning how to create for people. And so I'm hopeful that this information will make us only better able to control the future as a society, to be able to set ourselves up for success. I think one of the greatest dangers of the conversation happening right now around technology is that there's so much negative speak from the media about how screen time is digital heroin, and that we are turning into screenagers, and we're less connected as a society. And it's almost this doomsday talk about the future. And I want to nip that in the bud. I want to think about looking at technology from a different angle, that yes, it can look like that, but no, it doesn't have to. Let's change the way that we interact with technology. Let's use it better, because there are so many wonderful uses of technology that I think that we forget about in that conversation, whether it's the ability to bring some really incredible content to audiences around the globe through being able to connect on Skype, or it's people being able to FaceTime with relatives across the globe. I have been working with an organization called Enable that helps build 3D prosthetic hands for children in need. By going to your local library, you can actually help print out pieces of a prosthetic hand, assemble it over the course of a weekend for a mere $30, and send a hand to a child in need. Amazing, right? That would have normally cost $120,000 for one hand, and that child may or may not have ever received a hand to be able to interact with life. So you have these technologies that we don't want to ignore their potential, but we also recognize that if we're going to move forward, we're going to have better boundaries, strong boundaries that we have thought about very intentionally and that we're doing something about. And I think if we can figure that out, we can set ourselves up for a better future of happiness. And that's where I want to see us go as a society.
Wow, wow, wow. You're going to want to pick up your own copy of your book, The Future of Happiness, 5 Modern Strategies for Balancing Productivity and Well-Being in the Digital Era. We were talking about children. She actually gives resources in here for things to help you set boundaries.
Yes.
Regarding screen time, not just from, the gadgets I know themselves have some things built in with parental controls, but if you're like, I don't even know where to begin, pick up Amy's book, because she has some great resources in there for you to learn. And even if you don't, and you're the grandma or grandpa that's listening, you may need to get on, you know, I mean, I've been working with my mom. I'm like, Mom, you got to get up to speed here. Because, you know, it's interesting. I love technology, and you have to know and learn how to communicate with your children if you want to stay connected. And some kids get to the point where they talk more on via texting. Well, if you're one who's saying, I'm washing my hands of that, I don't want to learn how to text on my phone, you're going to end up losing connection, yes, forming a deeper relationship. And I do believe you can form deeper relationships while texting, not while driving, but while texting.
Absolutely. The research confirms that.
Oh, well, awesome. I love that. Absolutely. Well, and so I, you know, with that though, give us more hope here, Amy, because I think whether you're the grandma or whether you're the mom who's kind of like, oh, I'm just debating whether or not I really should do this, or, you know, give this perception of hope that there is a future of happiness, even with digital devices and technology and where we're going with it.
Absolutely. Well, to answer that question, I want to mention one specific resource that I talk about in the book to give people something to walk away with here to really think about how they can start to create those boundaries for themselves really quickly, because I think that helps answer that question about where we're going in the future. So one of the devices that I tried out, it's called Kids Wi-Fi, and it is a router that plugs into your wall like a nightlight, but it hops onto your existing router in your home. And what it does is it gives you an online platform to control what hours of the day your kids specifically can check the internet. So it doesn't affect my internet, but it affects theirs. It'll shut it down at 10 o'clock at night. I can say what kind of web searches I want them to have, and it'll block off things like gambling, pornography, things that are marketing to them. And then it gives me a feed about what they've been actually searching for as well. And what happened the day after I plugged in Kids Wi-Fi, my daughter came running to me saying, Mommy, the internet doesn't work anymore. And I said, oh, really? What happened? And she's like, I was just looking. She likes fashion a lot. And so she had been looking for the search term cute girl short skirt. And it blocked her. And I was like, score one for Mommy.
Yes.
Got her just in time. But what I realized is I had that experience was that this sense of peace and calm came over me. And I didn't realize how stressed I had been or how anxious I was in the back of my mind about the what ifs. I didn't know, you know, at any given moment, we hear about bullying online. We hear about sexual predators. We hear about people posing as different types of people. We've seen our own children interact in ways that are shocking because they don't think anyone's looking. So to have that safety net provided me such a sense of peace. It's so simple. I don't have to monitor it. I want to monitor it, but I don't have to actively go through and check when we have friends that come over to visit our house. I obviously am not on their devices. I don't have a control over their devices. And here they are bringing a phone or a laptop into my house. When they're in my house, they're using my Wi-Fi, and I get to set the boundary now that controls what they might show my children and what my children might show their children. And it's, it is such a fantastic advance, so simple, and yet it gives me so much hope for the future that we can set these boundaries, that this is not beyond us, that these things are not moving faster than we can get ahead. We are smart women. We can figure this out, and we will score one more for Mommy at the end of the day. So that's my encouragement to all of the listeners out there, that we just need to get on top of this. We need to get grandparents on board, aunts and uncles on board, so that they can begin to help create that safety net for our children that I think should be there. As the founder of Kids Wi-Fi once said, you know, you'd never let your child go out and ride a bicycle without a helmet. Why would we let them get on the internet without the safety net? And I think that really honed in for me on what I want to create for my kids. I can't keep them in a bubble, but I certainly can set them up for success.
Well, it makes me think about when you're going to have children and you have to baby proof your house.
Yeah.
You that needs to be included now, is that you add the kids Wi-Fi, that it just becomes part of it, and then you don't even think twice about it. And like you said, you're setting boundaries for when their friends come over. So you're not, you don't have to worry about the oops that happen. Yeah. I mean, because the schools that have their tablets now, I mean, I know in our school system, and we are a very small rural district. I mean, just to give you kind of an idea, our graduating class size is 120 children.
Wow.
We're small, okay? But we have technology in our school systems, and it goes all the way down to kindergarten, and I think they're even introducing it into our preschool program.
Wow.
And so everybody has access now to tablets. So, you know, come on, people. There is a future of happiness in this digital era, but like you said, we've got to stay on top of it and know that, hey, you know what? We can make this a happy place if we so choose.
We can. I think there's so much guilt going around in society too right now about, you know, either that a parent might have messed up and their child did have an oops, or that other parents are saying, oh, you let your child have a cell phone, or you don't let them have a cell phone. Either way, there's sort of a judgment about the choices that we're making for our children and our families, that they may differ substantially family to family of what works for one child may not work for another child. But I think that as long as we're having this conversation, you can't go wrong. And I just want to free parents up out there who are hearing this, that that these are things that we can get better at. These are not things that we should even inherently know how to do, because this is all new space, and it's something that we will be able to prevail to create something better. The human mind is the greatest supercomputer ever created. So we just need to tap into our own creativity to stay one step ahead, and not in that frantic fight or flight sort of way where we're trying to escape technology or trying to hold it down, but really, how do we use it for its best and highest purposes to lift each other up so that we can connect better, so that we're using it to become better people, so that we're focusing in on what's really important, so that it's not just to drive our productivity, but that it's to drive us as people to find a greater sense of purpose. And all of that is within reach, but we do have to take just a few moments to take stock and set ourselves up with some very specific strategies to make that future possible.
Whoa, you are amazing, Amy, and you all will want to pick up a copy of her brand new book, hot off the press, The Future of Happiness, 5 Modern Strategies for Balancing Productivity and Well-Being in the Digital Era. You are going to want to be balanced. You want to be productive. We are balancing and trying to kind of juggle so many things nowadays. And so this book is going to help you. It's truly a hands-on tool. It's not just one of these books that you're like, oh, what is this all going to be? No, you get some good resources, some great strategies and tools built into this. So, yeah, it's going to make you think. It really is. And I love, Amy, that you have stepped outside of your comfort zone. I know you love positive psychology, but this is somewhat going against the grain with people who either don't like it or do like it. They, you know, there's a love-hate there, like you mentioned. Mm-hmm. And for that, you could very easily be judged. And so I just want to tip my hat off to you and say thank you for being bold and raising this, that we don't have to be fearful. The robots are not going to come and take us over.
Right.
I mean, you have some movie, things intertwined within your book. And I had to laugh because my husband loves The Matrix and all of that. And so it's not that I don't think they're great movies, but I'm not a movie buff. But I just kind of giggled through some of the parts because I was like, oh, yeah, I know we've got people out there that think that, you know what, we're going to be taken over by robots and what's going to happen. And I'm just like, really? Did you look inside this brain? So I'm just saying thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
My pleasure.
So I got to ask you this. Obviously, you're interested in positive, you know, psychology. This has been kind of your life's work. What was your personal takeaway after writing this whole book? And now you've kind of come off of that, the editing, and now you're just in the promotional stages of getting the information out there on your book. What's been your personal takeaway from all of this?
My personal takeaway is that the future starts with the present. So I sometimes lackadaisically think about where we might head in the future, and I'm pretty vague about what I think might happen. And what I realized is that it's like a choose your own adventure book, right? When we were kids, you'd flip to the end of the story and you want to see, you know, did the monster die, or did the person live, or which was the funniest ending? I think that we get to choose our own adventure now. I think we get to write the ending, and I have a vision now that's much clearer about where I want to head. And as such, I think that now I can start to move in that direction. And so I want to encourage people that the future starts with their choices right now. If we don't want a dinner table filled with family all looking down at their phones and not communicating, then we need to do something about it right now. It just makes sense that we have this ability to control our own behavior. The very definition of optimism is the belief that your behavior matters. And so as I combine positive psychology with technology, I want people to know that. I want them to know that their behavior today matters for the future, and that it can be a really bright place. I'm excited about it, and I think this conversation is going to move it forward.
I know it's going to move it forward. And people are going to want to get in contact with you, Amy. They're going to want to find you. Where can they locate you? Of course, we'll have all of it in the show notes, but I want to hear it from you.
The easiest way to find me is to go to futureofhappiness.com. That's where you can find information about me. You can connect with me. You can share your story. I'd love to hear what people's stories are and how they connect with this information, as well as you can find me on social media there as well. That'll link you to all my Facebook and Twitter and Instagram feeds and my blog on Forbes and my Happy Tech blog. So I hope people will connect. I'm one of those authors that really wants to know what people are hearing, what they're thinking, what their feedback is, and the more that they can provide that, it makes my writing better, that I can address the needs and interests. I also have some resources available on the website as well that you can get to by emailing start@futureofhappiness.com, and it will send you some initial information about how you can start to put some of these principles into your life right now, even before you read the book. It's a good teaser to get you into the content and see what you get a sneak peek of what's in the book. So,
and they're going to want to pick up their own copy, Amy. I just know they are. It's The Future of Happiness, 5 Modern Strategies for Balancing Productivity and Well-Being in the Digital Era. We covered 2 of those strategies, stay grounded and create a habitat for happiness. We're going to leave the others. There's some really good ones that we could go deeper in. But you got to pick up your own copy because you're going to want to write. You're going to want to take notes. I did. I highlighted it. I put little stickies everywhere. So before I let you go, Amy, I have to ask you one question. This series is called My Strength is My Story, and you've written a lot about your story. You've shared some things with us. You've shared some things in your book, In the Future of Happiness. What has your story gifted you?
You know, when I was going through Hurricane Katrina, my husband and I had moved to Biloxi, Mississippi when he was stationed in the Air Force, and it was not, Biloxi wasn't really on my top 1,000 places to live in my life. Like, it wasn't where I envisioned myself being, but I tried to make the best of it. And we bought our first home and we got a dog and we made our neighbors. And then 3 months later, Hurricane Katrina hit and we lost our dog. We lost our home. We lost our community. We wound up leaving and never coming back for years. And so it was a struggle for me at that point to understand why does this happen? What does this mean in my life? What was the purpose of going through some of these experiences? And as I think about my own story and where I've come since then, it really is a place of wanting to help other people from what I've learned. And my research with positive psychology set me on this path to realizing that the external world does not determine my happiness. The weather doesn't determine it. The military doesn't determine it. My circumstances don't determine it, but that my life is what I choose to make of it. And so since then, I think my story continues to change and evolve and become a windy path, but a really beautiful path of being able to share those experiences and learn from other people as well.
That is a beautiful gift, indeed. Yeah. Thank you, Amy, so much for your time and sharing with us all of your thoughts. And of course, we will have all the information in the show notes so you can pick up your own copy of The Future of Happiness. Amy, I'd love to have you back whenever you would like. It has been truly my joy and honor and privilege of having you here. Have a blessed day.
Thank you. You as well. Thanks so much, Christiane.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Feeling inspired, ready to train for life, and love your journey? Visit createyournow.com for more incredible resources to help you along the way. We'll see you next time on Create Your Now, Your Best Selfie. And remember, always be sure you consult your physician before beginning any health and fitness plan.